Welcome to the Stabbin' Stylists Podcast. I'm Randa.
And I'm Ashley.
We are just two stylists who love true crime and hair, and we're going to tell you about both.
This is a true crime podcast. These stories may be disturbing to some. Listener discretion is advised. Hey guys, I really hope that you enjoyed my witch story from last week. And since this is the week before Halloween, it's the most wonderful time of the year. So I wanted to go back and take some of our favorite spooky thing stories and make a fun little Halloween compilation episode for you. We hope everybody has a great spooky week, and we will see you next week for a replay of our last year's Cleveland Spooky Things.
Today, I'm going to blow probably your minds and Ashley's mind, because she's not really heard of this yet, with the Rotherwood Mansion in Kingsport, Tennessee. Now, up to like a couple days ago, I had no clue this place even existed, and I went ham on it. I'm like ready to make a trip up there. This is wild, okay?
Thanks, TikTok, for introducing Miranda to this spooky.
That is the side of TikTok that I am on, and it is great. I suggest y'all get there.
I love it. I'll open TikTok and have like 13 notifications.
Because it's just all like spooky stuff that
it's good stuff, and obviously this is what we're looking for, and we didn't know about this until we saw it on TikTok. So thanks to the Southern Creepy creators on TikTok, and if anybody has any favorite ones, send them to us.
Yes, please, absolutely. Find us on TikTok. Send away. But today we're going to talk about Rotherwood Mansion, which is in, as I said, Kingsport, Tennessee. So what happened was Frederick Ross and his family inherited like a big tract of land on the Holston River. And there's like two different forks there. And he has like acres and acres and acres. This is a huge piece of land. And so he builds this beautiful mansion on it. This is a three-story house. It has a garden and a rooftop pool. Now, we're talking 1818 this house was built, and as many other wealthy landowners in the South, they did own slaves. And while that does not excuse owning slaves, they were, as all, you know, reports go, that was the place you wanted to be. And they were very good to their slaves. In fact, freed a lot of slaves. I read that there are like actual underground railroad tunnels under this house.
So that's a big part of the story, and we will be respectful about that. But yes, just kind of to let people know, that's part of the story.
So at one point, Ross has a daughter named Rowena. And Rowena is absolutely stunning. She's beautiful. She's fair-complected, dark raven hair. She's beautiful. And there's a lot of guys who are coming after Rowena, but there's one who catches her eye in particular. And this guy proposes marriage. And so they're going to get married. And Dad is so happy. He builds them an identical mansion across the river. But instead of the red brick, it's going to be white. Well, it burned to the ground.
Oh no.
So that was already a bad sign. So roll around to wedding day. Forget the burned down mansion. This is going to be great, right? So all of the families are there. They're gathered on the bank of the river to watch these two get married. Rowena's in a room on the third floor that overlooks the river, getting ready, putting on her wedding dress. And this big dum-dum decides he's going to go out in the Holston River, which is notorious for having wild currents, and crazy eddies. And he's going to go out there and he's going to go fishing to blow off some steam before they get married.
He was like, this water looks safe.
This looks super safe. It is not. So he gets out there. They're paddling out. They've got their fishing poles out. And all of a sudden, the boat capsizes. Boom. Four men into the water. Three men make it back to shore. The three groomsmen make it back, but the groom is lost in the river.
Because, I mean, this is like an 1800s boat, too. Mm-hmm.
So Dum Dum capsizes, and they actually never find his body.
Oh.
Never find his body. Now, some people report that, like, Rowena watched this happen from her room on the third floor, you know. And then some say that, like, she learned about it right after it happened. But at any rate, she's devastated. 2 years later, she starts to date again. Gonna get married to this nice guy from Knoxville.
Edward Temple.
He dies of yellow fever.
Oh, I had high hopes for her this time.
Well, third time's the charm.
Right.
Does get married. They stay married for 6 years. She moves away from Kingsport. She has a daughter. But she comes back to Kingsport for a little vacation, visit her parents and such. And while she's at the house, she swears she can hear her first love calling to her from the river.
Oh, no. And they never found his body. So he may not been.
And at one point, it's reported that she sees an icy white hand reach up from the river and beckon her in. And so she goes upstairs and she puts on her first wedding dress. And she walks slowly into the river until she's disappeared. And she drowns in the river.
Oh, no.
But so that is another death
at Rotherwood that happened.
And after this, Mr. Roth goes into a very deep depression, gets into some financial troubles, and decides that he needs to let the plantation go. And he knows that the only person who can afford this is another man in town by the name of Phipps. Now, Phipps is an overseer, and he is known to have a very cruel hand with the slaves. Ross decides that he is going to free as many of the slaves as he possibly can before Phipps takes over.
Okay.
Now, some of these slaves go on to settle in different parts of Tennessee, including like Zion Hill and those likes. And some of those ancestors take the last name of Ross. So they adopted his name. And some of those people would later become the ancestors of Diana Ross.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Yes. And I had no idea about that connection until I started researching this case. That was wild. But yeah, so Diana Ross is connected to
Rotherwood
slaves that were freed because their master was scared of the man that was going to take over. Turns out Ross was right because Phipps turned into a very cruel man. Nobody in town liked him, not even the white people.
I can't lie. He sounds like a real jerk.
He sounds like a dick. He installed a whipping post on the third story.
Oh, so he doesn't just sound like a real asshole.
In what sounded like probably was Rowena's old room, because he wanted to hear the screams of the slaves that were being beat.
That's gross.
All through the house.
That is gross.
Well, this man gets his, let me tell you. But this man was a son of a bitch. This quickly became a plantation you did not want to go to. It gets a little graphic past even the beating of slaves. He had apparently a mixed woman that he took as a mistress, and his wife did not question it. Like, that's how scared she was of him.
Ooh.
Did not question it at all. This woman was apparently just as bad, if not worse, than Phipps when it came to the torture and the punishment of other slaves. She, too, took pleasure in the screams of people. And they built a slave cell in the bottom of the house. They dug out a cellar that only had one entrance and exit. And it had bars over the doors. And it was dirt floor, dirt walls, under the house. And that's where the field slaves were grouped together. and store it at night.
I know I'm not going to say this right, but this is giving very Madame Lullery vibes.
Very much so. And I mean, this place was like freezing in the winter, sweltering in the summer.
Right.
And it's there was no outhouse there. There was no nothing. So it just was terrible. Whereas before these slaves had full bunk houses with kitchens and beds. And
right.
They were treated at least like
humanely.
People.
Right.
That was no longer. One day, Mr. Phipps comes up with a fever. And nobody can figure out what it is. He's just, knocked out. Old-timey fever, right? I personally think you got hicks, sir.
I was thinking in my head, it's from your meanness. That's what it is. It's from your meanness. That's, if you carry that on the inside, that...
it's gonna bubble out, right? He is quarantined away from the rest of the house, so he won't get anybody else sick. And there's a slave boy that is assigned to fan him because it's hot and he's hot. So he's gonna sit here and fan Mr. Phipps as he's laying in the bed just, sweating, nasty.
They didn't have central heating there back then.
Yeah. And so he's knocked out, fever coma, basically. And this boy is fanning him sitting here. And all of a sudden, Phipps sits up with a horrified look on his face. And is staring over this boy's shoulder. And the boy is like, what? And so he slowly turns around to see what Phipps is staring at. And there's a massive cloud of black flies.
Ew.
And it just keeps growing in number. And then all of a sudden, it swarms on Phipps's face. And they start burrowing into his ears and his nose and his mouth and his eyes. And this man chokes to death on these flies.
It sounds like he deserved that, though.
He pretty much did deserve that. Well, and so the boy runs out, sprints out to go get the doctor, gets the doctor. They come back in the room. And Phipps is dead. And there's not a fly to be seen.
What? Ooh, that was some evilness.
And so everybody's like, all right, he's dead. We got to bury this son of a bitch, right?
Right.
And like, no lie, everybody in the town is low-key celebrating about
right,
it.
Right.
Because nobody likes the sadistic
he was a
son
terror.
Of a bitch.
Right.
And so they go and they hook him up in the casket. They're going to take his ass to the grave plot, right?
Because you've got to think back then, too. Just because they didn't like him, there were, like, certain standards that they had to do, like, for the funeral.
Right. Because he was a wealthy man.
Right.
And not because anybody liked him.
Right.
But because he was a wealthy man.
But that was just the time. Like, they were like, well, damn, this guy was an asshole, but we got to do this.
Right. So they hook him up in the hearse, and they hook up two horses, and they're going to take him up to his grave plot. Right? They hook up a horse.
Yeah.
Horse. And then the hearse is behind it, right? We've all seen like that.
Right, like the
hearse carved up, and they put the casket in and take. Well, they start to go, and these horses are having a really hard time pulling this casket. Now, Phipps was not like a huge man or anything, but two horses should be able to pull this, no fucking problem.
Right.
Well, they hook up two more horses, and they finally get it rolling, but they're still struggling. Right. And everybody's like, what the hell? And so at this time, clouds start coming over and it starts looking like it's going to rain. And as they're making their way up the hill by the river, all of a sudden the river swells and it's full of mud and it is raging. And while everybody's looking over here at the river and they're kind of all like, what is going on? Behind them, the casket starts to vibrate and shake on the hearse. So about the time everybody turns around, this big black dog busts out of this casket, lands on the ground, snarls at everybody, and runs off to the woods. At this point, everybody's like, oh, hell no, get him in the ground.
The devil done came out of this moon.
Right. Hellhounds are around.
Right.
So they take him up, they get him in the ground, and they start throwing dirt on him. And all of a sudden, it starts to thunder. And in that thunder, they swear they hear Phipps's laughter. So everybody gets him in the ground. We disperse, right?
Yes.
Get the hell out of there, say their last rites, and run, right? So back at the plantation, Phipps's wife is still living there. There's still slaves there. Everybody's still going about their days. And a lot of the slaves are reporting to their overseers that Phipps is keeping them up at night. He's torturing them. He won't let them sleep. And he's sending his big black dog in the middle of the night. And so the overseers get tired of hearing this. They're like, he is dead.
Right.
Right? He's in the ground. I'll show you. So they gather up all the slaves and march them up the hill to the graveyard. They dig up Phipps, sling open the casket door, and there's nothing in that coffin.
Oh.
So they're just as confused as everybody else at this point. They put it back in the ground.
It's not just that. They're like, if this coffin, why was this coffin so heavy if it's empty, too?
Was Phipps the big black dog that jumped out of the coffin?
Yeah. Yeah. Because that evil didn't die.
After this, there are some reports of both Rowena on the grounds and Phipps and the dog on the ground. One of them comes from a worker who was doing some remodeling on the house. And him and a partner were working down in the basement, which would have been the slave cell.
Right.
And they're working, and all of a sudden, this one guy, they're facing each other, and the guy looks over the other guy's shoulder and is horrified, like goes ghost white, and then jumps back and then hightails it up the steps out of the house into the van and takes off down the road.
I would be like, you're not going to leave me in this haunted ass house. No.
Well, it takes him about 30 minutes to even call and tell the guy who's still there working what happened. And he tells that guy that out of nowhere, a man in a black suit with a huge black dog with glowing red eyes came out of the wall. And then the dog lunged at his throat. And that's when he jumped back and took off up the stairs and out of the house. And this dog was on his heels the whole time, nipping.
See, now, ghosts are weird, but I'm scared of animal ghosts.
Well, he gets in the van and hightails it, and this dog chases him down the driveway until he crosses into the road, and then it disappears.
So was he the dog, or was the dog, like, a familiar to him, but not a good one?
I don't know if that dog was, like, the evil spirit that was attached to him.
Right.
Or what, but yeah. So that is the Rotherwood Mansion in Kingsport, Tennessee.
It's a private residence. I just looked it up to see if it's...
Yeah, a doctor owns it now, I think.
Well, I wonder how he's doing.
I think it's a lady.
Oh, I wonder how she's doing.
I don't know.
Well, that's terrible.
I don't think that, like, she really only talks about, like, the history of the play.
Right.
And not really about, like, the ghost part of it, you know?
Oof. That sounds like it's got some bad juju attached to there.
Yeah. So that one's real spooky.
And this is the reason that you don't turn plantations into wedding venues.
Amen, sister. Like, it might be beautiful, but that is some bloody ground.
Right.
So a lot of people from Chattanooga have heard of the Reed House Hotel, and I was really, really excited to share this one because I am personally obsessed with Reed House. The Reed House is actually the oldest continually ran operational hotel in the South.
Wow. That's that's something to be said.
Right. That's pretty awesome.
That's weird.
It's cool.
It actually started out as the Crutchfield Inn. In 1847,
The Crutchfield.
I can't do that.
You can't roll your R's.
No.
All right.
Well, yeah.
You think you know somebody, you know what I'm saying?
I hardly made it through Spanish class. It was a very difficult process for me.
But
In 1847, the Crutchfield family bought this property and they built a lodging house that was 4 stories tall. And
that's big.
That is big, especially for them. And the railroad was coming through. So that's the whole reason that they did that.
Oh.
And Thomas Crutchfield actually later became the mayor of Chattanooga.
Chattanooga Choo Choo Railroad. Hey.
Right. The property was converted into a makeshift hospital for soldiers during the Civil War. Because
mm-hmm.
Chattanooga was a huge back then. So for both Union and Confederate soldiers, it was a hospital for them. And
there were several battles in and around Chattanooga, so...
Well, actually, September 20th of 1863, they accommodated 500 soldiers all in one day. And that was the last day of the Battle of Chickamauga, and it was one of the bloodiest battles in the Civil War.
And it's close. It's very close to Chattanooga.
In early 1867, the lobby flooded because the river is right there, and it actually rose 57 feet.
Wow.
Right.
That's a lot.
Oh, gosh, yes. And then the Crutchfields just couldn't get a break because it burned down. So they were just like, forget it. We're not rebuilding this.
Right.
That's fine. In 1871, a doctor named John T. Reed and his son, Samuel, they found it and they were like, all right, we're going to build a hotel here. The Reed House opened on New Year's Day in 1872. Just a few years later, it flooded again.
What? Y'all gonna have to move this.
They said it was only 4 feet this time, but they said that it was like a rapid current of water that was like moving through the hotel.
Wow.
In 1875, it served as a hospital for those suffering from yellow fever.
Oh, that's no.
I actually one day will do an episode on some spooky yellow fever places in Chattanooga, because that's something a lot of people don't realize. Where I've been on literally like 10 Chattanooga ghost tours, there are so many places in Chattanooga that was badly affected by yellow fever. So that'll be a really cool like history deep dive to get in for an episode one day.
Yeah.
And there's a murder connected to it. There's
all kinds of stuff. Well, now I'm going to have to go up to the cemetery and look and see who all died in 1875.
Right.
Yellow fever.
The yellow fever. Obviously, this hotel has just had a horrific past. There's been suicides. There's been all these deaths. There's all kinds of stuff. One of the huge ghost stories that you hear about the Reed House Hotel is in the basement, you will see disembodied body parts floating around in the air like they're floating in water.
So like if they like the basement was probably the morgue.
Exactly that. When in the Civil War, the basement was the morgue and it was like even kind of flooding then because, I mean, they built this right on the water.
Well, and it's the 1800s.
Like, right.
They're not going to be able to seal it.
So technically, I guess those bodies would be Civil War bodies kind of floating around. And not just that.
Well, and I mean, you got a leg shot off, an arm shot off. You had to amputate it back then. That was some gruesome work.
Well, that was another thing, too, that people say is this was a hospital back then. So it's nothing to see a ghost that's like missing an appendage in a Civil War uniform on either side of this like dying man. Because think of how many people, they saw 500 people in one day.
Shoo.
Think of how many people would have lived through that day back then, you know?
Right.
Very, very haunted already. And the Silver Ballroom is actually especially haunted. They say that you can see John Reed in there. And that if you look in the mirror, sometimes he'll be looking back at you.
Ooh.
But the biggest story that you hear about the Reed House is room 311. And I actually have a picture of Yuri outside of this room with orbs in it.
Oh, let me see it. I haven't seen it yet.
Okay, we're back. I had to show Randa the picture of Yuri, and I will put that on the Instagram because it's spooky. And it was spooky season, too, so it was perfect.
Yeah, and there's like a weird mist in one half of this photo.
Yeah,
that's a weird one.
That's
I would
weird.
Like somebody with more psychic abilities than me to look at it.
Oh, yeah. This is about room 311. And you can actually stay in room 311 now.
We need a girl sleep.
Oh, gosh, uh-huh. Yes. It's booked out for Halloween for like years and years and years. But you can stay in this room. And this room has been remodeled back to the 1920s.
the whole room. It has a closet bathtub.
You need to pray on an equinox. That's what
that would be really cool. That would be so cool. During reconstruction of the hotel in 1926, they kind of did like this big remodel.
Well, in Art Deco, the Roaring Twenties.
Right. And you got to think this building was starting to get really old by then. So it probably just needed like updates and stuff.
Yeah.
Many believe that room 311 is haunted by the ghost of Annalisa Netterly.
What a name.
There are many, many different stories as to what happened to Annalisa. Some stories claim that she was a prostitute who was brought in by a Confederate soldier who beheaded her and left her in the bathtub.
Oh.
Some claim that she had came to the hotel with her lover and her husband had came in and found her and killed her in the bathtub.
She died in that bathtub, though.
Another one is that her lover left her and she committed suicide in the bathtub. So all of the stories go back to the bathtub. People report in room 311 weird noises, running water, shadowy figures, and the particular dislike of men, especially men who smoke. She's been seen roaming the hotel and she's described wearing a white dress. Whenever you start looking into the documentation of like sightings, a lot of people say she was pregnant. When she died, she would have been in her 20s and maybe she wanted to have children. So her ghost was thinking that maybe it's a whole nother ghost. Who knows? But one thing that everybody agrees on is that you can tell her hair was supposed to be in that 1920s polished bun, but it's all tousled around and messed up. We can only assume from being murdered in the bathtub. But that's not the only crazy story about room 311. Al Capone, the famous Prohibition era gangster, stayed in room 311 waiting for his federal trial in 1931. Security bars were placed on the windows and they were not removed until the 2004 renovation.
Why would you take them off?
I don't know, but they did.
I wonder if they're in a museum around Chattanooga.
Surely, or some collector has to have their hands on those. I don't think they just tossed them. Surely not.
There's no way.
What happened to the bars?
Where are the bars? I need to know the bars.
But that is the room 311.
Hashtag, where are the bars?
Right, where are the bars? Yeah, the Reed House is cool.
If you guys know what happened to the bars, please tell us.
Yes, we want to know what happened to the bars.
Chattanooga Historical Society, where are they?
Where are they? So let's talk about the biggest reported ghost story in Tennessee.
Who?
And that is the Bell Witch.
Other than Ashley's house.
So the Bell Witch. I think pretty much everybody in Tennessee has heard of the Bell Witch. It's not the Blair Witch.
Yeah, not the Blair Witch, not to be confused.
Which was...
Although, isn't it kind of like loosely based on the legend of the Bell Witch?
I think I always heard that.
Yeah.
Back after I found out it was fake because
the
I
first
was...
found footage fake.
Yes. Oh, yes. I remember going to see that with my stepmom, Melissa, and like her friends.
It is one of the only like genres of horror that like absolutely gets me where I'm like, oh, no, I don't like that.
Well, and especially back when it came out, because we believed that shit was real.
Oh, yeah. Because it was marketed like it was real.
And it wasn't like now. There was the internet, but not where you could just find anything. And those actors, I've actually read, went into hiding for a little bit to make it like seem more
real.
Seemed
like they were, yeah, it was a real thing.
Anyway, yeah, that's a fun story, but that's not what we're talking about.
No, not absolutely not.
We're talking about the Bell Witch. So John Bell was born in Halifax County, North Carolina in 1750. And in 1782, he married Lucy Adams, which was actually the...
Please tell me why I just started singing Way Back Yonder on the channel. She thinking about how long ago that was.
That was a long time.
Instead of Way If nobody else does, I think I'm hilarious.
I do too. I think I'll start laughing all the time and be like, so I'm so funny.
I'm so funny, guys.
John married Lucy Williams, who was the daughter of a prominent farmer, and they actually ended up buying a farm in, like, the same county, and they began getting, you know, money real quick.
That money.
Wealth and influence very quickly.
Okay.
So in 1804, the family at this point was John and Lucy, and their children were Jesse, John Jr., Drury, Benjamin, Esther, Zadok, Elizabeth, Richard Williams, and Joel Egbert. They all built a house and started a farm on 1,000 acres located on the Red River in Robertson County. But only a decade after moving to their new farm that they were so excited about, they found themselves in the center of an epic haunting. John Bell actually first came across this animal sitting among like the rows of corn on his property, and it was said to have had the head of a rabbit and the body of a dog.
Hmm.
Yeah. And that's what he thought too, so he shot at it, missing.
Well, back in, you shot at what you didn't know about.
That's true.
Yeah, that's what they did.
That's true. So it disappeared, but this was just the beginning, and, you know, he probably shouldn't have shot at it.
I mean, I don't know if I've had the balls to shoot at something like that.
Well, this is where the origin of
the Bell Witch begins. I would be afraid that it would come after me, you know what I'm saying? That's what I would be.
I've talked before in a spooky episode about how I feel about ghost animals.
Well, that sounds an awful like a familiar, if you ask me.
That sounds terrifying.
I mean, it ain't just something as simple as a jackalope, you know what I'm saying? This is a dog with a rabbit head.
Right. Well, I'm sure he wished he didn't shoot at it whenever, you know, a spirit emerges and says, "I am a spirit. I once was very happy, but I have been disturbed and made unhappy. I'm the spirit of a person who is buried in the woods nearby, and the grave was disturbed. My bones disinterred and scattered, and one of my teeth was lost under this house. I'm here looking for that tooth."
She had a lot to say.
This can't be verified, but there were, like, tons of Indian burial grounds around the area. Personally, I'd be like, let's find this tooth.
Let's dig it up. Where's she at? Point me in the right direction.
Well, that same evening, the Bells began hearing sounds of someone beating on the walls of their log cabin, and it would go all night.
Don't love that.
The following night, the sounds returned again and again, night after night, becoming louder and more forceful each evening. Each night when the noises began, John Bell and his sons would rush out and be like, "We're going to catch somebody's mess."
Who the fuck is out here?
There was never any evidence. Mm. So over the course of the following weeks, the unexplained activity eventually became to manifest itself inside the cabin.
Oh, she inside.
The call's coming from inside the house.
The call is inside the house.
The youngest Bell children would often awake in the middle of the night complaining on the sounds of rats gnawing on their bedpost. But there were no rats and there was no damage.
They need some cats.
The cats will get rid of that witch, guys. Mm-hmm, just get the cats. The children would also claim their bed covers and pillows were forcibly pulled from them in the night and thrown to the floor.
I don't like that either.
The whisper started next.
Oh, no, thank you.
At first, the sounds were too low to be distinct about what was being said, but it was a tone and a rhythm.
I have a small question. At this point, would we not be trying to move?
I mean, personally, I would.
You know, I mean, we've got 1,000 acres here. Why do we have to have the cabin on this one?
Over there looks fine.
You got 990 lot more.
I got 999 acres, and this ain't the one. This ain't one.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to take some time, because again, this is like 1700s, but I will just be reaffirming. I'll be like, I'm moving it.
I will pick up this whole house and move it. Just tell me what you need.
Spirit lady, can you help me out? I mean, you're beating on the walls.
Spirit lady.
Well, all I'm saying is I'm not above bargaining with a ghost. Okay? That's all I'm saying.
They probably should have started bargaining with her at this point, because the whisper started low, just kind of like a tone and a rhythm that reminded them of a feeble woman singing hymns.
Nope.
Like the beatings on the walls,
absolutely,
they would get louder. In addition to hymns, they would start quoting scripture.
Mm-mm. No, don't like that.
It would carry on intelligent conversation with members of the family. And once quoted word for word religious sermons that were given on the same day, 13 miles apart.
Okay.
They did not see that stream live on Facebook. There was no reason for her to know, I say her, for that entity to know that.
They ain't had cars. No. She wasn't driving over there.
No.
And sitting in the back pew.
Nope.
I don't. No, thank you.
So Dr. Mize from Simpson, Kentucky came to exorcise the witch and was
exorcised the demon.
Well, he was mocked and frightened away. She bullied this man off of the property.
I mean, we stay in a confident queen, but this could prove to be problematic.
Well, and she also extremely disliked the family slaves.
Yeah, I'd say so.
She would torment them relentlessly, beating them and refuse them into the house. No, she was a horrible, horrible entity.
Okay, so here's what, in my mind, I thought she was, like, mad that they had slaves.
No, she was mad.
No, she was just an asshole.
She hated everyone.
Okay, well, we gotta exercise your ass out of here. You gotta go.
Well, a Bell slave named Dean stated that he encountered the witch several times, and if she appeared frequently in the form of a large black dog or a wolf, sometimes with two heads, sometimes just with no head.
I'm sensing a thing.
He also claimed to be turned into a mule and attacked several times by the witch.
He was turned into a mule, and then I'm presuming she was a wolf and attacked.
Yes, I assume.
Okay. I believe me.
You know I don't like ghosts. Animals, once again. So
it's a no from Ashley, dog.
It's a no from me. So initially, John Bell told his family, just don't talk about it. Because back then, you did not talk about this kind of stuff. I mean, let's be honest. That's not going to make any friends.
They hang people for less. Let's just put it that way.
You don't want to tell anybody. But he messed up because he told James Johnson, his friend and close neighbor.
James told everybody else, didn't he?
James told his wife, and he actually offered to spend the night in the home with him, but that would be terrifying for him because he too would hear the bangings and the whispers, and actually jumped up out of bed and said, "In the name of the Lord, who are you and what do you want?" But
well, we know that ain't gonna work.
Well, no reply was given, and the least rest of the night was fine, but he shouldn't have told his wife.
Because she told everybody.
Yes. Once he learned, you know, it was a matter of time before everybody knew. And the word was spreading so rapidly that people started traveling to the Bell Farm to see this.
Really?
But the neighbors and the visitors were not immune from the witch. And even in one time, she set sicked three dogs on traveling Shakers who were coming by the farm. Just like
she just said, here's some dogs that are gonna eat your ass alive.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I don't like this.
You know, all these visitors are coming by to see, and one of these visitors was actually President Andrew Jackson. Now, Jackson wasn't a president yet.
He was problematic as he was.
But at this time he was still a major general, and this was 1819 when he visited the home. Turns out that John Jr. Drury and Jesse had all served under his command at the Battle of New Orleans in 1815.
Interesting.
And so they were like, hey, our farm back home in
Tennessee. By the way, our house is fucking haunted.
Right. Like, you should come see the ghost. Kind of like me in my house.
But we know your ghost.
So the future president came to the Bell's property with, you know, several other men, horses, and a wagon. And upon arriving at the Bell property, these horses suddenly stopped. Nope. And they
you
would
can't
not go
tell
on.
Me them horses weren't like mm-mm.
Exactly.
Mm-mm. Y'all not see her? No.
Jackson proclaimed, "By the eternal, boys, that must be the Bell Witch." And in response, an unknown female voice called out that the men could now proceed to the house and that she would visit them later. Suddenly, without prompting,
that's not a good thing.
The horses started to go.
Weird.
So that evening, which, you know, it was quiet at first, and I'm sure he might have been getting a little bit disappointed, being like, what's going on here? And Jackson was a self-proclaimed witch tamer. And he began boasting and taunting the entity.
Spare me.
He proclaimed that the reason no activity occurred was a result of its fear of him and what he could do to it. Without warning, he began to scream and his body violently jerking about in all directions as though he was being beaten and stuck with pins until eventually he was flying headfirst and out the door of the house. The same female voice that they heard earlier.
You're a little bitch, didn't you?
The voice returned and threatened to expose the torment and another fraud within the group if they continued to stay in the house. So Jackson's men were like, let's get the fuck out of here.
He said, all right, dog bit.
He insisted on staying because he wanted to know who the so-called fraud was. He was like, no, let's stay. Let's find out who the fraud is. But she never ended up telling him. And the following morning, they were out of there.
Gone. They gone.
So Betsy Bell, the daughter, was most frequently abused by the witch. And this witch hated her. Nobody knows why, but the witch hated her. And when she decided that she was marrying her fiancé, Joshua Gardner, the witch said, no, you are not. And she would, like, abuse her and just taunt her relentlessly. So Joshua ended up being like, you know, no, we're going to stay engaged. It's fine. But then Betsy was like, no, let's put off the marriage for a little bit. So the attacks ended up getting so bad that she was just, like, even not even on the property.
Why wouldn't she
just
get married and move away?
Well, she did eventually. But, like, even off the property, she would get smothering sensations and this.
Oh, really?
Yes. And I even have an incident that she described. She said, when the spirit became so tantalizing, filling my mind with horror and causing me to become so nervous, my parents often sent me to a neighbor's for the rest of the night. My first night away from home was spent with Thinny Thorne. When we retired, there came a loud knocking sound outside our door, which seemed to fly open and a great gust of wind was felt. Thinny, that's a cute name, sprang up at once and lit a candle. To our surprise, the front door was not open. Then a voice softly spoke, Betsy, you should not have come over here. You know I can follow you anywhere. Now get a good night's sleep. A soft hand patted my cheek and the voice again assured me that it would not be disturbing me anymore that night.
Oh, she just said, just so you know, I'm here, bitch.
Mm-hmm.
Just sit with that for a minute, yep. She said.
So the rest of the family would send Betsy to stay with their friend Frank Miles because they were like, you know, Frank can protect you. He's there for you. And Betsy said, Frank was one of the most powerful men any of us ever saw. He was just as fearless as any living man. One time he said to me, come sit by me, my sweet little sister. Nothing will bother you while I'm here. And the witch responded, you go home. You can do no good here. The witch began abusing Betsy, slapping her, pulling her hair, and turning on Miles, knocking him over.
What the fuck?
So, I mean, this spirit hated Betsy.
Yeah.
Don't know why, but she hated her.
Was not a fan.
She called off her marriage to Gardner, didn't get married to him. But eventually she was courted and she was married by her former school teacher, Richard Powell. So even though this witch was like constantly beating the shit out of her and hated her, in 1820, she just up and left. She and her husband left and settled in Mississippi. So yeah. She finally did just get away, which good on her.
Yeah.
On December 19th, 1820, John Bell just couldn't get out of bed anymore. And John Jr. went to the cupboard to retrieve the medicine for his care. And instead of pulling out the three medicine vials, he only found one. It was 1/3 full of a dark, smoky, liquid, unknown substance. The voice of the witch said, it's useless for you to try to relieve old Jack. I've got him this time. He will never get up from that bed again. She claimed that she gave old Jack a big dose of it last night, and that was he was fast asleep, which fixed him. The contents of the vial were thrown into the fire and erupted into a blue blaze.
That's dramatic.
John Bell died December 20th, 1820. The Bell Witch crashed the funeral, disrupting the service and singing body drinking songs. Damn. She's relentless.
Even at the funeral,
like, she had it out for them. John Bell's funeral was actually one of the largest ever held in Robinson County. And as the friends and family left the graveyard, she was like laughing. The singing did not stop until the last person left.
Wow.
So After John Bell's death, she wasn't around other than her demand for Betsy's marriage to not happen. That was really the only thing that she had been worried about, and that John's death had kind of fulfilled her purpose. Yeah. That's what she was after. So the activity dropped off pretty sharply, but it was kind of still active through 1821. Soon she came and she told the family that she would be gone for 7 years. True to her word, the family remaining on the property, which was Lucy, Richard, Williams, and Joe, claimed the witch did return February 1828. Same way as before, shaking beds, unexplained noises, just being a real asshole. And before she left, one more time, she promised that in 107 years that she would come back to the direct descendant of John Bell. But there's really been no other specific instances since then. She became known as the Bell Witch. Mary Catherine Cat Batts lived near them, and her husband kept a small farm where they raised, you know, 5 children. Mm-hmm. And her husband had actually been paralyzed in an accident, which left her to be the primary breadwinner. She's the one that kept the farm running.
Yeah.
And they never really had much money, and she was known as rough, tough, and eccentric, which back then was not okay for a woman.
Well, she was just a bad bitch doing what she had to do.
So she tended to make a scene everywhere she went.
Of course.
She was confronting, she was arguing, just being the main attraction, just being
Well, she had Kate. To stick up for herself, or right. Nobody else was gonna.
She had shit going on, you know? So, of course, this meant that people said that she was a witch.
Well, yeah.
Kate and Frederick were actually neighbors of the Bell family. And, of course, Kate didn't get along with people. So Kate and John didn't get along. And one time they even became violent in an argument that they were having.
Violent?
When John Bell died, the family, you know, blamed the Bell Witch. And somehow the Bell Witch ended up getting the nickname Kate from the residents. They started suspecting that actually Kate Batts was the Bell Witch. And despite avidly denying any involvement in either witchcraft or anything to do with this, Kate Batts actually outlived John by 22 years. There's no connection to her as the witch, but she's said to be the Bell Witch.
Hmm.
And, you know, this cave, the Bell Witch Cave, people go visit it. It's a huge attraction. It played a very minor role in this story. The cave really doesn't have much to do with anything, but just through the years, it has become where people go to
like the place to go.
Yeah, because you gotta think the house isn't there anymore.
Right.
So people go to the cave and people say that, you know, they can't take photographs or get weird photographs and stuff like that. But now the only place to visit is the cave because the Bell Witch house is gone.
Well, if the house is gone, maybe she got her fucking tooth.
I mean, the Bell Witch sounded like a real asshole. It might have been Kate. Kate might have just been a separate asshole, you know?
Why would you even be mean to the slaves? They didn't ask to be there.
I know. They're like, we don't want to be here either.
Anyway, so yeah, she sounds like a real gem.
Yeah, she was wonderful.
We are going to talk about a couple of spooky things out of the Appalachians. Both of these are part of Cherokee legend and lore.
Love that.
So a lot of this is just spoken word oral tradition.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the stories vary. So I tried to kind of walk the middle here. So if I misspeak on any of this and somebody would like to correct, please.
Do let us know on that one.
Yes, because these are cultural stories, and so I want to be as respectful as I possibly can be. So today we are going to talk about the moon-eyed people of Appalachia. According to Cherokee legend, the moon-eyed people were small, pale, light-haired, blue-eyed people who inhabited the Appalachian Mountains before the Cherokee migrated into the area. Because the Cherokee are part of the Cree people, and they traditionally did not actually call this area home. They settled here later, migrated down here. And the Cherokee say that the moon-eyed people were here when they got here.
Which I immediately thought, God, think how long, like, old they would have to be.
Yeah. One of the theories that I think is really interesting that somebody has posed is that the moon-eyed people were like a leftover race from the Ice Age, like the first apocalypse.
on Earth, you know, which I thought was kind of interesting.
That is. You always say these hills are older than bone.
They are. When the Cherokee migrated down, like I said, the Moon-Eyed people were here. And their pale blue eyes were sensitive to sunlight, which made them mainly nocturnal. So they would come out at night, and even like a full moon, too much for their eyes. So they did all of their like tending to gardens, gathering food, all of that at night. They lived mainly underground, like in caverns and caves, but also in, I presume, would be like an underground city. They drove the Moon-Eyed people out by attacking them during a full moon when their eyes were sensitive, right?
It's a good strategy.
The legend states that the Moon-Eyed people stayed on their side of the Hiwassee River in present-day Murphy, North Carolina, and the Cherokee stayed on the other side of the river until the Cherokee expelled the Moon-Eyed people. Soon, the Cherokee found out why the Moon-Eyed people warned against crossing the river. A giant red leech resided in the river, and when the Cherokee tried to cross, the great leech swirled and bubbled the water so that it swallowed up all the Cherokee that were attempting the crossing and swept their bodies downstream, where they were recovered with no noses and no ears.
Creepy!
Mm-hmm. The river crossing would later become kind of like a rite of passage for braves, those brave enough to cross the river.
You could lose your nose and your ears.
Hey, you might get swallowed up by a leech. But that's one of the first like lessons that the Cherokee have, that the Moon-Eyed people warned them.
And, I mean, and they told you not to do that, guys.
Exactly. There's a reason they said, hey, don't, it's not because they didn't want to get attacked. It's because they were like, "That's don't do that, that you gonna die." Who could the Moon-Eyed people be? There have been a lot of theories on this. Because this is not the first time that the Moon-Eyed people pop up in legend.
Right. Could not they the first just, place either, right? There are other places.
Could these just be early European settlers, right? It's theorized that these could be part of the Welsh Indians. Most likely the now extinct Mandan people, a tribe known to speak a language very close to Welsh, and some had blue eyes. They built round boats and teardrop-shaped dwellings in the Welsh and Irish Scots style. Prince Madoc, who was an illegitimate child of the King of Wales,
scandalous,
sailed to the Americas in 1107, and landed in what they believe he landed in what is like now Mobile Bay, Alabama, forming a settlement and eventually sailing back to Wales to collect more settlers to bring back over, right? However, there is only oral history and legend to support this story, and there is no written record of Prince Madoc. But again, it is said he is an illegitimate child, so would there be written record? England would use this legend as proof of claim over the Americas. In 1799, settlers found six skeletons with breastplates bearing the Welsh coat of arms.
Okay, so that story's probably true, because I was like, this is 50-50 shot on if this is true, but that's probably actually true.
Just like in a riverbank in North Carolina.
Yeah.
Reports from Tennessee Governor Sevier of Welsh-speaking tribes in the Tennessee Appalachians, there was a reverend who was doing colonizer shit.
Mm-hmm.
And Reverend Jones' life was spared by a pale, blue-eyed native chief who spoke a language close to Welsh, was able to communicate with him through speaking Welsh.
That doesn't sound coincidental.
Many people believe that the Appalachian Mulungeon people are direct descendants of the Welsh Indians.
Oh, that makes sense.
I mean, I'm not debating that the Welsh Indians existed or not. Right. I think, yes.
Yeah.
But do I think they're the Moon-Eyed people? No.
Okay.
Let me tell you why. Stone walls at Fort Mountain are seemingly built in the European battlement style, a wall almost 900 feet long, up to 7 feet tall and 12 feet thick, dating back to 400 to 500 CE, that the Cherokee say the Moon-Eyed people built. And it was there before they got there, too.
Oh, this is kind of like the pyramids.
Exactly. The only artifact we have depicting the Moon-Eyed people is a soapstone statue that is about 3 foot tall and roughly 300 pounds, which depicts two small figures with large eyes, like the eyes are like way big on the face, and flat faces. They're kind of like dished almost, yeah. Faces. So moon-faced. It was discovered by a farmer plowing his field in the early 1840s and is now on display in Murphy, North Carolina.
You know, Fort Mountain's only in Chatsworth. Yeah.
Interestingly enough, fairy crosses and stones are found in North Carolina. Cherokee legend states that the tears of the Moon Eye people are what formed these stones. So it seems that the Cherokee believe in the Fae Realm.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Now let's talk about a little something that I find interesting when we talk about the Moon Eye people. If you think about pale haired, said they had like white beards, like white hair, pale skin, blue eyes that are very sensitive to light. What does that sound? That sounds like a person who has albinism.
Yeah.
It is possible that the Moon Eye people could have simply been albino, which would explain their pale skin, hair, and eyes. The Kuna tribe of Panama has the highest rate of albinism in the world. One out of 145 Kuna are albino.
And that's genetics. So you've got to think, like, the Moon Eye people are only with Moon Eye people.
And that's in Panama. Trek right up here from Panama.
Right.
Traditionally, because of their albinism, they were given the task of guarding the moon. Other native tribes share in the high rate of albinism, including the Hopi tribe, who were descendants of the ancient Pueblo people who built all of the cliff dwellings.
Yeah.
So, who knew? Like, albinism runs in native tribes at a higher rate than Caucasians.
That's really interesting.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you would have to have melanin to not be able to produce melanin.
That just really, it sounds like an Ancient Aliens episode.
When I started looking into this, I was fascinated.
That is really interesting. Now I want to look more into that. That's like it's on Netflix. It's like Ancient Archaeology or something like that. And it talks about all of these pretty much like extinct races now, like Mayans and stuff like this, and how they were thousands and thousands of miles apart, but like had the same stories, kind of like Moon Eyed people, like it's shown up in different stories.
Right. But I mean, like, think about how long the Cherokee people have, and the Moon Eyed people were here first.
That says a lot. They would have to be old. That's very interesting.
And how far those walls date back is what is kind of crazy to me.
And we have so many like hollows and hills. I didn't say it right. It should have been hollers and hills and woods and so many unexplored places.
On the blue side of the mountain, you
still
know?
Still to this day, you know? Yeah. So,
hey, there's hollers out there that don't even see sun, you know?
Like, so I believe it. That's like Bigfoot. Bigfoot very well could be living in the woods of East Tennessee somewhere.
I tend to think that if the Moon Eye people did indeed exist as a race of people, I think that they were probably, like I said, like a leftover from, you know, the first round of humanity.
Right.
Or they're part of the Fae Realm.
Yeah. That's interesting.
That scares me. But, yeah.
Not all fairies are nice.
No. No. Real fairy stories. No. Yeah. We've Disneyed them up real good. But no, fairies are not nice.
They're
fairies
not all mean as hell.
We're going to talk about the legend of Spearfinger. The Cherokee believe in three worlds, like we talked about last time. Right? There is essentially what we know as the heavens, the underworld, and then our plane of existence, right? And everybody coexists in all three worlds, essentially, right? And within these realms, there are portals where you can move between worlds, right? But only in certain places, which is where the story of Spearfinger begins. Spearfinger was a female shapeshifter whose right hand bore a long spear of a finger she used to cut out people's livers and eat them. Okay.
Oh, okay.
Now, her body was basically clad. And side note, this is not the only legend where we hear of these like long index fingers from the Cherokee. They are weird about long index fingers.
Because Judicola had long.
Had long and he was seven fingered. So the Cherokee Cree people really are. I feel like they hold like hands and have a lot of power for them, you know?
Well, you've got to think that's what made that's their what they living. With. That's what they work with. So that's
what they made art with.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
But yeah, they hold a lot of power in hands. So anyway. So Spear's finger's body is clad in stone and she had power over stone. So like she could essentially telekinetically like pick stones up and move them.
Okay. Different places.
And she could slam them together and it would fuse the rock together. And Spearfinger would also, because she's a shapeshifter, would disguise herself as like an elderly grandma or like a small child in the community to get into your house to eat your liver.
This has very Skinwalker vibes.
Yes. And she would also like lure children away. And generally, she would try to take, like, she would watch you, and she would try to take the form of your loved one.
Yeah.
So you would feel at ease, and you would just come, right? And initially, the victim would be unaware of their missing organ. They would have no idea that they were missing their liver until eventually they just weakened and died. She would take her big old spear finger and
just
pull your liver out and eat it and put you all back together. And then you were fine until you weren't.
That's terrifying.
And her favorite time of the year was fall, when the Cherokee would burn leaves on the ground to harvest the chestnuts. So they would do controlled fires, essentially. Then they would burn, and then the smoke signal would go up, so she would know where the Cherokee were camped at.
Like, you're literally telling me where you are.
Exactly. So she would see the smoke, and then she would go to prey on the people. Knowing this, the Cherokee tried to stay very vigilant, but they never knew if someone who stepped off to go to the bathroom, went down to the river, or went to go gather something, when that person came back, was that them or was that Spearfinger? So a council meeting was held to determine what are we going to do about Spearfinger before she's end up eating everybody's liver and killing us all. And so many plans were proposed, but trapping her in a pitfall. So you dig a pit, you put ground cover over it. When she walks over it, she would fall in the pit. And then
run-of-the-mill booby trap.
Right. And then they would attack her from above. Boom. They got her, right? And so they were like, yes, this is the best way. So they set all this up and they dug a pit, they camouflaged it, and they set a fire to lure Spearfinger, because they knew if she saw the smoke, she would come.
So she thinks she's coming to a buffet.
She's like, ooh, I'm going to give me a taste of a little treat. And she came disguising herself as a village elder, and many wanted to shoot, but there were some that were like, no, like, A, if you shoot and she's not Spearfinger,
you just killed
somebody's grandma.
Right, yeah.
And B, if she doesn't fall in the trap, we're screwed, basically.
Right.
And Spearfinger did fall into the trap. And when she did, she let her true self show. She dropped her disguise. And she started stabbing at everybody with her big, long spear finger up above. Right? And so the Cherokee are standing up there avoiding her jabs. And they're shooting arrows down at her, but her body's clad in stone.
That's the, when they said shoot at her, I was thinking, don't shoot at an entity. This is like Bell Witch. You don't
her body's clad in stone. Yeah, so it's all just bouncing off of her. And she starts trying to climb out of the pit. And they're like, ah, shit. And so they're trying to beat her back down in the pit. They're still shooting arrows, all that stuff. And all of a sudden, the little chickadee birds around start singing, the heart, the heart. And the Cherokee fire the arrows at her chest. But nothing's landing. And then a little chickadee bird flies down and lands on the tip of her spear finger. And the Cherokee realized that that's where her heart was. And one of the best marksmen they have waits for his opportunity, fires his arrow, and hits her right on the tip of that spear. And she dies. And from then on, the Chickadees are known as the truth tellers for defending the Cherokee against Spearfinger.
I love that. Go Chickadees.
So yeah, I thought that Spearfinger's story was pretty fucking crazy.
Who would have ever thought the birds, they work for the bourgeoisie, you know? Who would have ever thought that they would be the heroes in the story?
Little old Chickadees.
Little old Chickadees.
She comes out only on Halloween. On Centenary Avenue, she can be seen. Tall Betsy is the lady in black. For scaring night owls, she has a hack. Now, if you're good and go home early, you won't get got by this gruesome girly. But if you linger till after 10, we want you to know you're a has-been. 'Cause Betsy will tuck you under her arm, and you can bet that's cause for alarm. To Fort Hill Cemetery she will go, to her mausoleum, with you in tow. If you don't escape before sunrise, I warn you now, you will be her prize. She will have you for breakfast, I do not jest, you'll be on the menu, but not as a guest. Your bones she'll dump in that old well at Arnold's school, and no one will tell. Your parents, they'll worry and they'll fret, they'll search for you all over, I bet. So go home early on Halloween night, and November 1st, you'll be all right. Trick-or-treating is so much fun, but if you see Tall Betsy, you better run.
Don't whistle in the woods at night.
Bye, y'all.